Hello and welcome to the New Books in Native American Studies podcast. My name is James Mackay. I'm an assistant professor in British and American Literatures at European University Cyprus. Today I'll be talking with Linda Lagarde Grover, and the book that we'll be discussing is her recent collection of 50 short meditative non-fiction essays, Anigamesing, Seasons of an Ojibwe Year, published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2017. Linda is a distinguished scholar who's received multiple awards for her teaching and for fictional works, including her short story collection, The Dance Boots, her poetry collection, The Sky Watched, and her novel, The Road Back to Sweetgrass, which won the first book award from the Native Writers Circle of the Americas. She's a member of the Boys Fort Band of Ojibwe and also serves as Professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota Duluth. But a relationship to Duluth and the Duluth area goes much deeper than that, as this book bears witness. Bonjour, Linda, and welcome to the New Books Network. Miigwech for the opportunity to discuss this wonderful book.
Well, bonjour, James, and miigwech for having me here. It's quite a pleasure to talk with you today.
Can we start by talking about the inspiration for the book? What is it that appealed to you about the essay form, and what inspired you to put these particular essays together?
Essays are very short, and they are based on a series of newspaper columns that I was writing for a local paper over several years, and kind of combined and reorganized and rewritten, and with some new essays written. They seem to follow a seasonal theme, but it is not only seasons of the year, which is something that is at the foundation of many Ojibwe writings, I think, because of where we live, where our seasons are so distinct and our traditional lifestyle has been based on those, you know, what the gifts of each season are. But also this, as I'm looking at this stuff, it looks like it really is the seasons of a person's life, and then not just my life, but the seasons of a human's life. And so that's why, you know, the seasonal theme just seemed to emerge on its own as I was going through these and putting the book together.
Okay, I mean, I noticed that one of the first pieces in the opening section, Siguan, which means spring, begins when you say, when I was a little girl. And then the last story, the last section, begins with the first time a young woman acknowledges me as an elder. So is this book a kind of autobiography of yourself as part of what it is?
I suppose you could call it a memoir. It is my own experiences as an Anishinaabe woman in Anigamesing in Duluth here. So it is that, but I think that it is a collective story too. And it's, and I did try to bring some of our I guess you would call them our traditional beliefs about the beginning of the world and how things were created and how we are supposed to be acting and reacting to things. And so it is not strictly an autobiography then in that way, but I think it is sold as a memoir.
It's sold as a book of essays and a memoir, but in terms of memoir, maybe you could give our listeners some idea of your background, of where you come from and your upbringing.
I was born in Duluth, and Anigamesing is an Ojibwe word for Duluth, and it means, the translation to English is the place of the small portage. And we're on Lake Superior, a very large lake, and there is a kind of a long sandbar here where years ago Ojibwe people could portage. They could cross over land in, you know, a very short distance there, maybe a 2-3 blocks. And it was an easy place to cross as you're traveling by water. And I was born in Duluth, and I was born actually fairly within blocks of the big lake myself. My family moved here, oh gosh, probably 100 years ago or so, from two different reservations. My grandmother is from far north, two, three hours north of here. And she is from the Boys Fort Band, that reservation. And my grandfather was born north of here too. And he is from the Fond du Lac Band, the Fond du Lac Reservation. And so that's my background as a person who is, you know, of of the people here and of an actual native nation and born in Duluth, which has a, you know, fairly good sized native population, mostly Ojibwe. I'm the oldest child in a very large family, and I've lived here, I don't know, most of my life. I lived up north for a while.
Okay. In terms of schooling, you were schooled in Duluth?
I went to Duluth Public Schools, and I graduated from high school, which was not usual at the time that I was in school in the late 1960s. Actually, it's not all that common these days. Our graduation rate is not very high for many, many reasons. And I started school at the University of Minnesota Duluth here, but I failed in my first term here and never went back to school full time. So I've had, you know, many different jobs in my life, many different things that I've done. I'm married. I helped put my husband through college. I have children. I began to work in Indian education programs when I was expecting my third child and I was living up north. Indian education programs were brand new in this country, and a small group of parents could get together and apply for a small grant in their school district. And I became a part of that. And then after a while, began to work in that program in Indian education programs. This would be in like the late 1970s. And I've been working in Indian education or involved in Indian education ever since. I've worked as an Indian education director or worker or advocate in public schools. I've worked in that job at a community college, and I've been working as a professor in American Indian Studies at UMD here for, I think this might be my 13th year. So I haven't done this all my life, but I do love it. It's my best job so far.
And what does Indian education mean in this context?
It means programs that are funded by government funds, by state or federal funds, that are there to enhance the educational experience of American Indian students, and ultimately to improve things like academic performance, school attendance, and graduation from high school, and attendance at colleges and universities, or wherever else they would like to go to further themselves in their lives. You know, some go to a trade school, or to a community, or to a tribal college run by various tribes, and some go to universities, and some go to a combination of all of these, which is actually what I did over my lifetime. Education is a precious thing, and it is a sacred trust that has been something that has been held as a great responsibility and great honor to be part of in Ojibwe culture and tradition for many, many, many generations. And so for those of us who have worked in Indian education, we feel that honor, and we feel part of carrying something forward that has changed greatly since, you know, our great-grandparents taught the young. But still exists the education and the preparation of younger generations for their responsibilities in the world.
So what can you do to bring that old culture of education in line with the requirements of SATs and so forth? How do you combine the two?
We must live that and make that the foundation of our lives to continue as Anishinaabe people, individuals or collectively. And so I do not think that these that Anishinaabe way and Anishinaabe teachings and majority culture teachings are exclusive of one another. I do believe that our Anishinaabe way is a source of tremendous strength and enhances whatever we do within an educational system. It took me a long time to arrive at that that piece of knowledge, I guess, which was there all along. And there are many, many reasons for that in our histories and in our current society that might make students feel that is not possible. But it's not only possible, but I think it makes our educational experience so much more for us and also for the world around us outside of Anishinaabe country.
How so?
Well, to teach and to teach, within reason, of course. I mean, as we're living our lives, we teach by example and even in our everyday speech and manner of doing things. And our Anishinaabe way of doing things, Mino Bimadasi, when is translates to the living of the good life. And in that, in teaching that to the rest of the world, it's something that certainly our grandparents and grandparents and grandparents strove to do, and they did this for a reason. And so it is a great honor to carry on what they began in a changed world. You know, I mean, they didn't. Our great great grandparents learned everything at home and in their communities that they would need to know to be good Anishinaabe people, good contributors of to the society around them, and to live lives of gratitude and modesty and generosity. They were taught that by older people. There was a great disruption in this with our boarding school system in this country. And I know that in my family, three and perhaps four generations of families were subjected to a schooling education that was designed to actually annihilate all Anishinaabe beliefs. This would include religious beliefs and that philosophical, that worldview of living the way of Mino Bimadasi. And so it is quite an adjustment over many generations to be able to survive in an educational system and not feel that we are expected to abandon all that is important and essential as Anishinaabe people.
And you mentioned a concept a couple of times there, Mino Bimadiswin, which I'm probably pronouncing terribly, which it's such a central concept in Anishinaabe culture. And it's I think, quite difficult for someone who's not brought up in that culture to get an idea of what that means. Would you define it a little?
Bimadiswin is the living of a life, and the implication is the living of the good life. And I guess it's the life of Anishinaabe values. In probably, I don't know, the last 20 years, maybe, the word Mino seems to be used ahead of Bimadiswin, and Mino would translate in English to good. And I think that is there to really emphasize the goodness of the life. And so Mino Bimadiswin is based on basic Anishinaabe values and teachings, which is that we were created. There is a creator who made everything. We understand that we don't make anything, that we have been given many, many gifts, that we are to be, really, we should be thankful for this. So we're thankful every day. We understand because of this, we are rich. And we understand too that because we're rich, of course, we would be generous with others who might not have the same things that we have. And so we respect ourselves and the world around us, and we are aware of those who were before us and those who will come after us. It's a very basic, I guess you would call it, based on spiritual, on religious beliefs.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask about next. It's a form of religion, but it's a way of living with a sort of spiritual consciousness. Would that be a way of saying it?
Yeah, and I do believe that spiritual consciousness is not even, I don't know if that's stressed so much because it is so basic.
Okay, yeah. I mean, in terms of concepts like these, how limiting is it writing in English for you rather than in Anishinaabe Mwin?
English is my first language, so it is, you know, it's easy for me to write in English. And I've always really liked reading and listening to stories. And in my family, there have been some fine storytellers and, you know, recounting of history and an organization of things to make it to make the tale interesting and instructive and entertaining all at the same time, which I think is the traditional way of teaching the, you know, the creation stories, the sacred stories. So I've always enjoyed a good story. and I always kind of hope that I might become somebody who could tell the story myself. And as I got older, I had several older relatives who, once I was well into adulthood, I wondered why they were being so generous with me in sharing so much of this with me. And then I realized that it wasn't just because they like me, though I think they did, but I think they felt that, yes, here's another of the people who will be surviving to tell the story. And, you know, surviving sounds like a really grim word, and I guess that it is, but it is a miraculous thing. My husband tells me that that any Native people are around today, and so to be able to tell stories is a great privilege. I think I have been given a great gift in the opportunity to be able to do this.
Yeah, it's that's where business survivance comes in so nicely, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, with Anishinaabe or any Native language, we have some real difficulties sometimes with language. You know, it's not my first language, and you know, I'm not a fluent speaker by any means. And what I do know is just what I've learned from hearing and stuff. Though nowadays you can take it in school here at UMD at the college. You can take Anishinaabe language, Ojibwe language class. But during those boarding school years, and that was a very long time, it was many decades, the native languages in this country were supposed to be eliminated. And so children were not allowed to speak them at school. And the language, you know, our Ojibwe language was greatly affected by this. Now there is a revitalization of the language with the teaching in schools and stuff, but it's a long road back.
Oh, well, it's an act of reconstruction, isn't it? Because so many words must have been lost through that process.
You know, many things have been lost, not just words, but much. My dad used to tell me this, that there are things that were lost during those days that we will never get back. And is it, you know, he wondered, he didn't feel it was proper to just go pursue them and, you know, chase these things down and grab them and reinvent them, because they are so sacred that in themselves they cannot be changed by what we think we might like to see or what we think we might like them to be. So, yeah, the language did change. There are things that were lost. There were always people who maintained these things, but it was at great price, and there was a great deal of damage done. We still live with that today, but you know, I believe that there's a, with the great damage that has been done, I think there has been a great appreciation for Indianness amongst ourselves, and we don't take it for granted. We're really sentimental about our children, and that is the reason that, you know, I mean, it's so many times it just sounds like such, it's become almost trivial to hear, oh, children are our future. But, you know, the fact is for any people they are, and with Anishinaabe people too, having lived for many decades and for generations in communities where we could not take for granted that we would have our children there, that we would be able to raise them ourselves or see them or anything. You know, my grandmother was like that. Her children were all, and my great-grandmother too, their children were taken. They were removed from the home. And so there is a great appreciation for having young life around and to understand that this is what our survival is. Survivance. Yes, I do like that word.
Yeah. In terms of that, this particular book here, you've written this in actually quite in many ways a deliberately simple style. I was wondering how much this is intended as an educational book for younger audiences as well.
You know, I was writing these columns for a newspaper that is it was a free newspaper, and it was around ever since, well, I was a little girl, and it was a paper that people in Duluth anybody could get it, and everybody seemed to read it, but especially people who would not be able to pay for a subscription to a newspaper. That was where they got their, that was what they got their printed news from. And so I especially liked writing for that particular audience, which is very broad and very general. And yes, I wanted it to be something where I could, you know, maybe share some experiences and share a little bit of what I, you know, what I know or what I think. But it also, I wanted to give an understanding, if I could, that there is a basic, what an older man who was reading it called it, a brotherhood. He said he sensed that when he read my stuff in the paper, that we certainly are all in this together. There have been some really difficult things in the past. There are difficult things in the present, but there's also tremendous beauty and just wonderful stuff about Anishinaabe and all Native tribes here. And so that's why I did it. It's simple, but then the tone of what we would what I would have heard from an older person when I was a young woman would have been simple in its tone also, and that's what I was kind of striving for, something that would be natural. In my other books, I tried to do that too. I wrote them thinking about, you know, my aunts and my mother reading them, you know, that generation reading and recognizing things, going, oh yeah, I know about that.
Yeah, it that explains why one name that kept coming to mind when I was reading it is Jim Northrup's, who also is someone who weaves wisdom.
Oh, Jim Northrup, yeah.
Yeah, is he someone you were reading? And
I knew Jim Northrup. Yes, yes, I've read with Jim Northrup at events, and also with my cousin Robert Swanson, who is a fine poet who lives up north, up where the Grand Portage Reservation is. So yes, the three of us in the past have read together, and Jim Northrup, you know, certainly has his wonderful, inimitable style of writing, his command of the English language, and then his integration of that with Ojibwe language and thought and worldview. He was a wonderful, wonderful writer and a very encouraging fellow writer to me.
How much is there now a distinctive Anishinaabe English language tradition of writing, do you think, which you and Jim would be part of?
A tradition of writing? Well, ours wasn't really a written language. It was turned into, like with English type letters and things, probably in the 1850s by Bishop Baraga, who made a dictionary, and then has, you know, has been, so there are English letters. There's very complicated syllabary of Anishinaabe too in the writing that I have absolutely no grasp on at all. But I think I don't know if it would be writing so much as it would be passing stories on to another generation. And I think that's what Jim Northrup was doing with his writing. And that's what I, you know, endeavor to do with my writing too, So it's the word, it's the story, it's the history, it's the how to act and how not to act, the good way to be. All of that is tied into the stories and tied into the storytelling. And so the written word is one form of this, I guess, is how I would put it.
Yeah, and another form is sewing and repairing things, which is a really big feature in this book. There's something I saw you say, there can be a lot of satisfaction in the making and remaking of things, which this book obviously is. What do you prefer, writing or sewing?
I enjoy writing. I like to sew. It's fun to make things. I'm a simple sewer, but I come from a family of, and mine is not unusual in any way, a family of people who have taken pride in remaking things, in using things up. And my cousin Bob, and you know, I do mention him in this book a couple times, I think. He calls it creative living. And he also mentions that it's a lot of fun. And so Bob's grandpa and then, you know, his mom and my dad were involved in this too, as was all the family, actually made and sold things. They made some of the traditional arts, and then they also made things that were out of what Bob would call the scraps, the cast-offs of larger American society, and made them into something useful or something fun or something lovely, and sold them too. And so that was a way, as the economy changed into more of a cash economy around here for Indians, probably, I don't know, around 1920, I think, might be a kind of a turning point in time there, the need to get some cash money for things. That was how our family did this. And so it was actually kind of a natural transition from using up everything that's around you anyway and making and remaking and making that into kind of like a little family business.
Wonderful. I'm sort of moving on from that to you've been talking so much about traditional community and storytelling and life ways. So something that really jumped out for me in this book is the number of references to Facebook. Why was it important to include social media in these essays? Or what appealed to you about that?
Goodness, I hadn't thought about that. I guess it's just something that we do. You know, there are sites on Facebook for like, there's one I really like called the Ojibwe Language Fix of the Day, where there's a whole bunch of people on there, and there's people using Anishinaabe language, Ojibwe, and asking questions about it, or sometimes making little jokes or making a sentence. And so that has been a part of language revitalization, but it's a means of communication that is just such a miraculous thing, I think. Goodness, I've connected with people I'm related to who I've never met through Facebook, and just somebody knowing somebody else. Many Native families were also, you know, the boarding school system, and I hate to keep, you know, bringing it back to that, but the effect was so profound and so long lasting. But after the boarding school era ended, and it was dismantled beginning in the 1930s in this country, but after that were other programs and historical events that also broke up families and communities, really fractured things. And, you know, there was the federal relocation programs of the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. There was a federal Indian adoption project, which placed Native children outside of Native homes. There, you know, there's the foster care system. There's all these things that really impacted our families and again, caused tremendous damage. And oddly, Facebook seems to have made it possible for so many people to get back and to get in touch. And I've been in touch with cousins that I never knew. And so it's just different, you know. It's kind of like, you know, my mother was, you know, when we had a She talked on the phone a lot to her girlfriends in the 50s and 60s when I was a girl at home, and it was just keeping in touch all the time. And this is before you could just dial long distance. So this would be people like on the other side of town, which is kind of a miraculous thing too, to keep in touch. And so I think Facebook does the same thing. I know it certainly has its drawbacks, but my goodness, it's made some things possible that have just been a lot of fun.
That's kind of interesting because, you know, obviously we're sort of in the era of the first social media president of the United States and so forth. So you're seeing it as a very positive thing, and technology generally is quite positive for ongoing community and relationships.
In that, I don't like opening up Facebook and seeing 50 posts where somebody's upset about, I don't know what, the president or something else. I just kind of skip over all this stuff because I actually like it just because I love so much seeing pictures or seeing what people I know are up to. And I know there's many people who feel obliged to share their something they read somewhere and send it all over on Facebook. I go, well, that's fine. You feel called to do that, but I don't really feel called to read that. Mainly, I'd really like to see what your kids are up to.
Okay, I mean, I sort of wanted to turn from that to another theme I saw a lot in the book that I don't think we quite touched on, which is sort of representations of Indianness and sort of striking back against a certain amount of ignorance in wider society. So you talk about Indian corn, you talk about Thanksgiving traditions. You talk about having to be the representative at school at various points. Would you talk a little bit about that?
It can be sometimes a little bit of an aggravating thing. Sometimes it's kind of funny. And so there's kind of like a maybe we would call it a parallel universe or parallel world of Indians and Ojibwe people and Anishinaabe people that is kind of watching this stuff as it goes on. And yeah, I mean, sometimes it can be a little aggravating, you know. What do Indians think about something? I think, my goodness, we've got 500 tribes here in North America. Every single one has its own way of doing things. They all have their own languages. They're, you know, there is not one common worldview. And so it is, you know, I always try to be, you know, as tactful as I can and not lecture people or hammer down on things like that. But I do kind of, as gently as I can, let people know that. I mean, I certainly can't speak for all of the Indians or all of the Ojibwes or all of the Boys Fort people or all of the Lagarde family. You know, we are all individuals with some things that tie us together. At the same time, it is kind of funny to go to the grocery store and see that, my goodness, in this day and age, they're still selling candy at Halloween and Thanksgiving that says really big letters on the bag, Indian corn. And they were doing that when I was a little girl. But, you know, I bought some. And actually, when I was going out and doing some readings out of Onigamesing, you know, at some bookstores and places when it first came out, since it was in Indian corn season, I actually bought several bags and passed it out and read that little essay to people. Indian and non-Indian people, and people got a real kick out of it, you know. And then there's people who said, I never even thought about that. And I thought, well, now you have.
That's just an example. It's so wonderful talking to you. You have such a sort of positive vision for the future, it seems to me. You think things are really healing here?
Oh, no, I don't think there is such a thing as healing. I sometimes I feel that there is a pressure on American Indian people to heal, kind of like you'd say to a dog, heal. No, I'm just kidding. But sometimes I will come across something where I will be speaking somewhere and someone will want to apologize. I go, just, oh my goodness. And I tell them, you know, you certainly didn't do anything, and you have a good heart, and you know, don't, you know, you don't need to do this. And I also wonder what that apology is supposed to do for anybody. It certainly doesn't make me feel any better. Does it make that person feel better? And that person didn't do anything anyway. Some of the things that have happened two Indian people are so, I mean, I think it is affected a change that I think there are things that you simply cannot go back. And so I feel that sometimes there is a pressure to, and now we're healed. And with the seventh generation, we're healed. And I think, no, now that I've been on the earth here for quite a while here, I see that no, we come to grips with things and we take what we can to make things the best that we can and try not to dwell on things every day. But there are some difficult things that, I mean, there are some things that cannot be just undone or fixed. And so I think we all just have to learn and to, you know, and to go on and live good lives, really. So sorry to say there's no healing, but that's, but I think that's one thing. If there's one thing I've learned, that's it. And I think, so then I think, well, then it's good to not be pressuring people to heal because that makes things even harder.
No, I think that really speaks to the sort of earned wisdom in this book. It's thank you for that. Sorry, what was the other thing? Oh yeah. You're now working at a university, as you say, for the last 13 years, and you're a professor there. How well are you able to combine being in a Western university with working in Anishinaabe intellectual traditions in the way you do?
It can be kind of a trick doing that. And if I'm going to make a choice at any point, at this point in my life, Anishinaabe ways, you know, certainly are always... always have precedence over other ways because of the, you know, it is quite a privilege to be in a position like this. And so in that, I really feel that any Anishinaabe people feel that obligation to serve the people and to serve that way first, understanding that, you know, that is the way really for the greater good of everyone. So yeah, sometimes it is a little bit, sometimes it's a little bit difficult. And in writing, I think that's why I decided, you know, I have this book of essays, but most of what I write is fiction. I have a fiction manuscript that I've finished just in the last few weeks that I'm going to be sending out. And I do think that through fiction, what I'm hoping to say and to share might be more effective than nonfiction or essays or research papers. I'm looking I'm looking for the same people who picked up the free newspaper, the Budgeter, and read it and saw my column. I always have, you know, those people, those Budgeter readers in mind when I write anything now. That's a luxury to be able to do that, I know, but it's also, I think, something that is very, very important and something that my dad and my grandparents, I think they would like to see that. And I think about that a lot. What would the people in the generations before me want to see?
It connects with what you're saying in the book about veterans and military service, isn't it? The service is such a core value.
Yes, large numbers of American Indian people have served in the armed forces for the United States, and that's kind of a outside of Indian country. Sometimes that is a surprise to people because, of course, they say, "Well, this country really caused you guys a lot of harm. How can you do this?" But the way it was explained to me once by a friend of mine whose husband is a Vietnam veteran, a combat veteran, she said, they are protecting us. They're protecting the land and the people. And that means the land and all the people on it, because we can, you know, this is, I mean, we consider it our land and other people here are our guests. That's the way I think of it. And in Anishinaabe tradition, when you've got a guest, you invite them in your house and you make sure they've got a nice, comfy place to sit, and you share what you have with them, you know, your food, and treat them well. And so that concept, I think, might be intertwined with serving others, and that includes serving in the armed forces for this country. And also there's the idea of the warrior who is selfless and courageous. And, you know, certainly a warrior is frightened as often as the rest of us, but is willing to do this for us. And that is such a part of the honor of being Anishinaabe. And I can't speak for the men, but I would say particularly for the men. But, you know, many of our women have served in the armed forces here too.
Yeah, but this sort of links, you know, everything that you've got in your book about domesticity, cooking, ironing, and so forth. That's just another form of service, isn't it? I'm not saying that it's as gendered as that, but there is something of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's doing for others.
Mm-hmm. If I can ask, what's the new manuscript that you've just completed? Is it a new novel?
Yes, it's my third fiction piece. My first one, The Dance Boots, focused on a century of a Northeastern Ojibwe family and really the effects of boarding school education on several generations of a family. My second book, The Road Back to Sweetgrass, focused more on the assimilation type policies of the boarding school, but also of the second half of the 20th century, and those effects, and that story is told through the experiences of some young Native women in northeastern Minnesota. I mean, you know, they do things like, yes, indeed, there is the backdrop of Indian policy, which is ever present in the books and in our lives. But against that backdrop, people are, you know, they're falling in love, or they're cooking, or, you know, you're right, they're ironing, they're washing dishes, and they're interacting with the world around them. But my third book then is about the generation that would have been born in the 70s. And that story is also told through women. I think there are men who tell some of these stories in these books, but I think the women are who the stories are. They carry the stories, I guess. And so in this book, then, these are two girls who go through the foster care system in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And then they grow up, and against the backdrop of history, they too live their lives. They get jobs. They, you know, do the things people do. Deal with their car, you know.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for taking so much time to talk to me. It's been an absolute privilege to hear everything. Thank you.
Well, James, thank you very much. It's been a privilege to talk with you.
Okay, so that's me signing off for the Native Books New Books in Native American Studies podcast, and keep listening. Thank you. Goodbye.